Bradshaw said.
What does that all mean, Poe?
It means the registration number was cloned to make sure it wouldn't be flagged as false or on the wrong type of vehicle.
Gosh, how clever.
It was. And because GU have the Northwest prisoner contract, they're on our roads all day and well into the evenings. You get so used to seeing them, they blend into the background. The immolation man had been hiding in plain sight. Flynn had left for her emergency meeting with Gamble. Hopefully, a coherent strategy on how to trace the GU van would emerge. But just in case it didn't. Poe glanced across at Bradshaw. She had begun to pack. She looked despondent. The excitement of the discovery had fizzled out once the information was passed to Gamble. The change in her was remarkable. A week ago, Data was simply a puzzle to solve, and once she had, it had been passed to Flynn and forgotten about. Other than in the abstract, Poe knew she'd never had to think about the human cost behind the data she deciphered. And now she had, he knew she'd be a better analyst for it. Sometimes cold reason wasn't enough. Sometimes you needed skin in the game. Being personally involved forced you to go the extra mile.
"You don't think we're done here, Tilly?" Poe asked, smiling. "Get yourself comfortable. We have work to do."
Bradshaw clapped. She opened her laptop, pushed up her glasses, and waited for instructions. Poe sat beside her and said,
"DCS Gamble's going to start checking the sales of those vehicles, Tilly. He'll need a warrant."
She waited for him to make his point.
"But if the immolation man is as intelligent as we think he is, the van purchases are going to be hidden. He won't have paid for them with a credit card, and GU wouldn't have sold them directly to the public themselves anyway. They'll have sent them to one of those companies that buy cars in bulk. The van we want could have been bought through an auction or through a subsidiary company of a subsidiary company of a... well, you get the point."
"I'm not sure I do, Poe."
"I'm saying we need to find a quicker way, Tilly. Let Gamble track the van through the paperwork. He'll get there in the end. But while he's doing that, I want you to think of another way to catch this prick."
Chapter 49. Bradshaw smiled shyly.
"Poe, what did I tell you a couple of days ago?"
It could have been anything. The topics of their recent conversations had been wide-ranging and varied, from the bowel habits of the elderly to why he was called Washington.
"I don't know," he said, before taking a guess. "Something about the gaming industry now being bigger than the music industry."
"About data points," she prompted.
He remembered something about data points. It had been one of those discussions where Bradshaw missed all his non-verbal clues and had enthused at length about some technical point in chaos theory. He found it easier to let her finish than try to stop her. It hadn't been long before his mind went into screensaver mode.
"It's possible I might have forgotten the salient details," he admitted.
"I said that with enough data points, I can find the pattern in anything."
"So?"
He got the impression his stupidity with statistics remained a source of intense frustration to her. Although part of him missed her unintentional rudeness, the fact that she was now keeping her comments to herself was testament to how much she'd changed.
"So," she said, pointing at the photograph-covered wall, "when I downloaded all those photographs, all I was working on was the days of the murders."
Realization dawned on Poe.
"Of course."
Now they knew the vehicle, they could get every ANPR record for it. Every time the immolation man's mobile prison had passed a camera, they'd know about it. ANPR records were kept for 2 years, and although they would end up with two records, there was still a GU van with legitimate plates working in the southwest. It should be easy enough to separate the two. Bradshaw was already inside the ANPR database. Within minutes, the printer was churning out sheet after sheet of information. She said,
"This is a good example of Edward Lorenz's butterfly effect, isn't it, Poe?"
"Mmm,"
Poe muttered, his mind full of auction houses and other ways vehicle fleets could be sold.
"The butterfly effect."
"I'm not following you, Tilly."
"I said, this is a good example of it, how one small seemingly insignificant event can snowball into what we have here.
Explain.
Well, all of this.
She waved her arms at everything on the desks, computers and walls.
And everything you and I discovered all came from that one small thing.
She shook her head, as if she were amazed.
The one thing that anchored everything else.
It was often how the harder cases broke. Small pieces of evidence led to larger pieces, and so on.
Yeah, we got lucky with that body in the salt store, he admitted.
Really? I think it goes back further than that. I think this whole thing goes back to a chance remark.
The printer's out tray was overflowing. Poe walked over and emptied it. As he picked up the sheets that had fallen on the floor, he asked,
What chance remark was that, Tilly?
When someone in Kendall Police Station reminded Killian Reed about the body in the salt store. He'd forgotten about Tolland Man, and you didn't know about it. It wasn't recorded as a crime, so I wouldn't have found it. Just think, everything started with that chance remark.
She was right, sort of. Poe was inclined to think it started when a psychopath carved his name into someone's chest, but essentially she was correct. Without Reed coming back from Kendall with Tolland Man, they wouldn't be where they are now. Bradshaw mistook his silence for disagreement and began pushing her point. Poe was no longer listening. He'd picked up the top sheet off the printer and was staring at it. Bradshaw had searched in reverse chronological order, so the most recent records were first. He hadn't been expecting to see anything he would recognize. This was Bradshaw's area, not his. But two results halfway down the page caused him to stop. A feeling of dread came over him. Acid churned in his stomach. His mouth went dry. The results he was looking at were from one of the cameras covering the A591. They were there to help track the gangs that supplied drugs to the heart of the Lake District. Unless they had extraordinary local knowledge, anyone travelling to Ambleside or Windermere, whether it was from the Keswick end or the Kendall end, would pass one of the A591 ANPR cameras. And Ambleside and Windermere weren't the only places accessed via the A591. There were several other small villages, one of which was Grasmere, where Seven Pines was located. The dates matched. The times matched. If Poe's notes were accurate, and he knew they were, the prisoner escort van had driven past the ANPR camera about 10 minutes before he and Reed had. Hilary Swift wasn't the immolation man's accomplice at all. She was his next victim. He'd abducted her and taken her grandchildren with him.
Chapter 50 The immolation man has the kids as well! Poe shouted into the phone.
Flynn was on her hands-free, and the reception was scratchy. As she was on her way to see Gamble, giving her the information directly was the quickest way of getting it to the right people. Flynn got the message, and even through the poor reception, Poe could hear the car's revs increase as she put her foot down. On the 1,000-to-1 chance that Flynn had an accident, Poe decided to cover all bases. He rang Reed, but it went to voicemail. He left a message and hung up. As far as he was concerned, the information had been passed on. He emailed Flynn the document showing that the immolation man's vehicle had been in the Grasmere area on the day Swift and her grandchildren had disappeared. He tried to calm his racing thoughts. Things were making a bit more sense. Swift being abducted was a better fit than her being involved in the murders. And in the scheme of things, including Poe's newfound theory that the case was motivated by revenge rather than money, it all clicked. Whoever the immolation man was, he was systematically working his way through everyone on the charity cruise that night. Only Montague Price had avoided his fate, and that was because he'd had the foresight to flee as soon as he recognized the pattern. The mechanics of snatching Swift from under the noses of two experienced cops were troubling him. How had the immolation man administered the drugs? Had he been in the house at the same time as they were? Had he sneaked in while they were talking to Swift and put propofol in the milk? A plan that relied on knowing when police officers were going to be drinking tea seemed too random for the immolation man. He'd never left anything to chance so far. It was typical of the case. Each time they made a breakthrough, more questions were posed. Bradshaw was still working on the ANPR data for the prisoner escort van, trying to find a pattern that might help them. In contrast to Poe's hunt-and-stab method of typing, her fingers moved so quickly across the keyboard they were a blur. The printer had been a constant whir of noise, and for the next half hour, Poe was little more than an office junior. He loaded the printer with paper and replaced empty ink cartridges. The staff must have been getting sick of Bradshaw's printer. She had exhausted the hotel's conference stock again, but Poe convinced the staff to steal ink from other machines in the building. Eventually, Bradshaw stopped.
"I'm going to need an hour to look at this. Can you go and get a map of Cumbria, Poe? The larger the better."
Poe was about to say he'd send someone out for it, but realized she probably wanted him out of the way while she worked. He'd been like a caged beast while he waited.
"Will do," he replied.
An hour later, he was back. Getting a map of the area hadn't been an issue. The shops were full of them. The issue was that the maps the shops sold were for tourists. They were geared for fell walking, not for driving. He'd been about to give up. He knew Kendall Police Station had a map that covered the entire wall. He and Bradshaw could take their data there and start plotting it. He was pondering this, the drawbacks as well as the advantages, when he glanced in the shop window he was standing beside. It was an age-concerned charity shop, and he saw a basket of maps in the window. He found what he needed, an Ordnance Survey tour map. He opened it up and saw the scale was just right for their needs. He gave the woman £20 and told her to keep the change. The map was pinned to the wall, and Bradshaw had fully plotted it. If there was a pattern there, Poe couldn't see it. Red and blue pins had been placed in clumps. He recognized some of the larger, more intense groups as the county's main thoroughfares, the M6, the A66, and the A595. Some of the smaller groups were around known victim abduction sites. Long Meg and her daughters aside, the other stone circles the immolation man had used as murder sites weren't heavily covered by ANPR. They were too rural. Bradshaw was frowning at the map as if something wasn't working.
"What's up, Tilly?"
Eventually she said, "This doesn't make sense, Poe."
"How?"
"It doesn't conform to my model."
"Explain. And use the crayon method, please."
Bradshaw usually smiled. This time she didn't.
"Well, you know that this type of profiling is to assist with understanding the offender's spatial behavior."
Poe didn't have a clue what she was talking about. He wasn't even sure he knew what spatial meant.
"Dumb it down a bit more, can you, Tilly?"
"An offender will have a natural aversion to committing crimes close to home," she said. "It's called their buffer zone."
Not shitting on your own doorstep, he'd have called it, but he knew what she meant. Even low-life heroin addicts tended to move into the next street before they started shaking hands with door handles.
"Well, conversely, they'll also have a comfort zone in which they feel safe. It's usually somewhere they know well. It's called the distance decay theory. The farther someone is away from their regular activity space, the less likely they are to offend."
That made sense, too. Poe was convinced that the immolation man knew the areas he was working in. It was the only explanation for him having avoided so many of the fixed-point cameras on the roads.
"But we know he wasn't picking his victims at random. He had a list he was working through. He had no control over where they lived," he said.
"I've built that into my model."
Of course she had. "So what is it?"
"It's the murder sites. That's the thing that doesn't make sense. There are three variables involved in each killing. Where he abducts the victim, where he keeps the victim, and where he kills the victim."
Poe thought he knew where she was headed, but he let her finish.
"As you say, the abduction points are out of his control, and if we assume that the site he keeps them at is a fixed point, then the only random part is the selection of the murder site."
"And there's no pattern?"
She shook her head. "There should have been, even if it was just the way he travelled to them. But I can't see it, and that means there isn't one."
She wasn't boasting, simply stating a fact.
"Perhaps the pattern is there is no pattern."
Bradshaw stiffened and stood up.
"I'm such a silly goose, Poe. You said Cumbria had 63 stone circles. He's used 4. Where are the other 59?
"All over the place," he replied. Off the top of my head, I don't...
Her fingers moved over the keyboard as if they were possessed. 20 seconds later, a document listing the county's stone circles shunted its way out of the printer. For the next 30 minutes, they plotted their locations on the map with yellow pins. He stood back. Bradshaw joined him.
I told you, Poe. Data never lies. There's always a pattern.
Without looking at each other, they silently fist-bumped. He didn't need her to explain. The immolation man's pattern could only be seen when it was placed within the context of the circles he hadn't used. He'd killed his victims at the so-called Big Three, Long Meg, Swinside, and Castle Rigg. They were sites of historical importance and known to an international audience, huge and impressive. Leaving a burning body in the middle was impact-heavy. But he'd also picked Elver Plain in Cockermouth. Why? There were more impressive circles he still hadn't used. Elver Plain didn't even look like a stone circle. Most people were unaware of its existence. Why hadn't he chosen a circle from the biggest mass of yellow on the map? Why hadn't he chosen one from the area known as the Shapstone Avenue? There were countless circles to choose from, some of them close to where they were now. Some of them were isolated but well known. They even had easy access to the M6, pretty much everything the immolation man needed. He thought about Bradshaw's buffer zone. Was it possible the immolation man hadn't committed any crimes in the Shap area because he lived nearby? Had they been looking out when they should have been looking in? The back of his neck started to bead with sweat. The room was getting warm again. He removed his jacket, put it on the back of his chair, and rolled up his sleeves. He could sense he was close. The answers were all there. He needed to look at everything through a different lens. He rocked his chair backwards and forwards, trying to think of something new. The rocking caused his jacket to fall on the floor. He bent down to pick it up. And paused. He caught his breath. His intuition had been telling him that the answers would be found in the past. That Price and then Swift becoming suspects were nothing more than a distraction. He'd never believed either of them had been capable of being the immolation man. His eyes moved from his jacket on the floor to one of the photographs on the wall. The four boys, topless and happy in the sun, puffing out chests they didn't yet have. He stood up and draped his jacket over the chair again. He looked at it, damp with sweat and hanging limply like a sock on a shower rail. His mind brought up a succession of images. Through memory after memory, he searched for the one that would disprove his growing suspicion. He couldn't find it. He blinked, and the images disappeared. His jacket. The photograph. There was a connection. His thoughts drifted back to something Bradshaw had said earlier. He hadn't paid too much attention, but it had been marinating because it was now jumping up and down in the front of his mind. The butterfly effect, she'd called it. She'd said that someone reminding Reed about Tolland Man being found not 5 miles from where they were now was the catalyst. The butterfly flapping its wings in Brazil that causes a hurricane in Texas. Without Tolland Man, they wouldn't have found the disturbed coffin, probably wouldn't have discovered the stolen Breitling. Quentin Carmichael would still be listed as dying in Africa, and the insidious purpose of the charity cruise would have remained hidden. But what if... Sometimes Poe's mind lay coiled and quiet, processing data at its own speed, but at other times he was capable of making huge intuitive leaps. A horrific, half-formed suspicion grew in the pit of his stomach and began to gnaw and gnaw. Neurons were firing, faster and faster as he made link after link. All the disparate parts of the puzzle came together and clicked into place. Confusion was replaced by understanding. Poe knew most of it. Maybe all of it. No one had been able to answer how the immolation man had managed to stay a ghost for so long. Fair enough. Anyone could learn police procedures these days. The Freedom of Information Act meant that most police manuals were publicly available. It was feasible that an intelligent, careful man could teach himself to be forensically aware. But how had he evaded the surveillance Gamble had laid down? The mobile ANPR cameras, the human surveillance on the stone circles, all the patrols. There was only one possibility. The immolation man had to be getting current intel. As Poe inched towards confirming his own theory, he thought of everything they'd uncovered over the last 2 weeks. He looked at his jacket and corrected himself. He went back further. The night of the charity cruise, and a plan that had taken almost 26 years to come to fruition. Logically, there was only one person it could be. The thought chilled him to his very core.
"Do you have the information sheet on propofol, Tilly?"
She found it and handed it over. Poe turned over the top sheet and looked for the sections on other uses. He ran his finger down the list and stopped when he found what he was looking for.
"Shit."
He glanced up. Bradshaw was watching him.
"I need you to check something for me, Tilly."
"What is it, Poe?"
After he'd told her, she frowned.
"Are you sure?"
she said softly. He found he couldn't speak. He nodded. As Bradshaw ran the information he'd given her, Poe paced up and down the room. It was the worst thing he'd ever had to wait for. He prayed he was wrong, but knew he wasn't. The result came onto Bradshaw's screen, and she turned and nodded. She had tears in her eyes. She wasn't the only one. Poe knew who the immolation man was. Chapter 51 Poe stared at the number on his mobile. There would be no going back if he made the call. No bell could be unrung. His finger hovered over the dial icon. Eventually he touched it. He closed his eyes as he waited for the call to be answered. She might not. She'd be involved in the search for the abducted children and trying to identify the owner of the prisoner escort van. He had to tell her before anyone else. He needed to convince her. After 8 rings, and Poe counted them with a heart that grew heavier with each one, Flynn answered her phone.
"Poe," she whispered, "I can't talk. DCS Gamble's just delivering his briefing."
"You need to go and get him, Steph."
"It'll have to wait. I've got..."
Poe spoke firmly.
"You need to go and get DCS Gamble, and you need to do it right now."
"I'm going to need more," she replied
after a small pause. Poe told her. There was a delay of 3 or 4 minutes as Flynn maneuvered her way through the briefing room. Despite the fact it sounded as though she was holding her phone at her side, Poe could still hear her as she excused me her way to the front of the room. It was tinny, but when she arrived, Poe could hear both sides of the conversation.
"It's D.S. Poe, sir. He says he needs to speak to us."
"Does he now?" Gamble replied. "Well, he's going to have to get in the queue. When I've finished here, the chief constable wants me to accompany him to the PCC's office. We're both in for a bollocking."
"You need to take this, sir. Trust me."
Poe heard Gamble sigh.
"Look, I know he's been a small help on this investigation, but we have missing children now. I really don't have time to waste on another of his theories."
Flynn didn't respond.
"Fine," he said. "We'll go into my office."
A minute later, Flynn put the mobile on speakerphone.
"Out with it, Poe," Gamble snapped. "I know who the immolation man is, sir, and we need to act now." "You do you?"
Gamble said skeptically. Poe ignored the rudeness. Gamble was under enormous pressure.
"It all comes down to a suit jacket at the end of the day, sir," Poe replied. "A suit jacket and the flap of a butterfly's wings." "What are you talking about, man?" Gamble snapped. "It's Killian Reed, sir. The immolation man is Killian Reed."
Chapter 52 It was Bradshaw who'd pointed him down the road he'd just travelled, rattling on about that stupid butterfly and how it kept causing hurricanes. She said the body in the salt store wasn't the anchor for this case. The anchor, the first flap of the butterfly's wings, was that someone had thought to mention Tolland Man at all. Without that chance comment in Kendall Police Station, they'd have been nowhere. But what if it wasn't luck? What if it had been intentional? other than fluking their way into the charity gala, the immolation man had been in control. To date, he'd been the puppet master. But why let them make any progress at all? It could only be because he wanted Poe involved, and he didn't want him too far behind. And as soon as he thought about it that way, like a beacon through fog, his connection to the case shone through. The immolation man wasn't trying to evade justice. He was delivering it. He wanted his story told, but only after the players had been punished. And with the investigation initially stalling and following cliched theories, the immolation man had engineered the involvement of the one man who might see through the smog of confusion. Poe, with his stupid follow-the-evidence-anywhere mantra, became part of his narrative. From the beginning, Poe had worried about motive, and with a case like this, when you had the motive, you had everything. The identity of the killer, what really happened on that charity cruise, how the victims were selected, everything. Poe could even take a stab at why the immolation man had killed the way he had. It all made a twisted sense. From the immolation man's perspective, it really did. It was a child snuffering that went to the top of Cumbria's social elite. A landowner, a solicitor, a media baron, a council member, and a member of the clergy. The immolation man was killing the people involved, but that was only half the story. He also wanted them exposed. But he didn't trust his own police force to do what was right. He knew his chief constable had ambitions higher than Cumbria. For advancement, he'd cover the reasons behind the castrations and burnings. He'd focus on the killings and nothing more. His story might never be told. That was where Poe came in. The immolation man needed his dogged determination to see behind the headlines and get to the real story. Reed had integrated himself into their investigation from the beginning, monitoring his progress, nudging them in the right direction if they needed help. It was Reed who sent him that postcard. It was Reed who told them about the salt store connection. Poe doubted anyone had reminded him. He probably hadn't even been to Kendall Police Station. Just came back to Herdwick Croft with an answer he knew Poe would obsess over. And because he lived in Kendall, he fitted Bradshaw's buffer zone and distance decay models. Poe even knew how he'd managed to abduct Hilary Swift. All that was suspicious, but ultimately circumstantial. Where was the motive? Why was he doing these monstrous things? Why would Reed, a decorated police officer with over 15 years' exemplary service, suddenly decide to become a serial killer? The answer was, he hadn't. He'd decided a long time ago. It was the jacket that provided Poe with the missing motivation. It didn't matter what the weather was doing, Reed never removed his jacket. For years, he'd taken the piss out of Poe's lack of sartorial elegance. Whether they were at work or on a night out, Reed always dressed well. In all the time he'd known him, Poe had never seen him without a shirt, jacket, or jumper on. He'd certainly never seen him in a T-shirt, even when they were teenagers. In the photograph of the boys, one of their nightmare starts to life had visible reminders. Matthew Malone had cigarette burns all over his torso and arms. Terrible scars that would never heal. Killian Reed's arms were always covered. Killian Reed was Matthew Malone. And Matthew Malone was killing the men who'd murdered his friends. Chapter 53.
"You're out of your fucking mind, Poe," Gamble said. "Out of your fucking mind!"
Poe had finished explaining. Gamble wasn't buying it. Even Flynn was reticent.
"It's a bit of a stretch, Poe," she said.
He needed them to believe him, and their reaction, although not unexpected, wasn't helping. "Tilly," he said calmly, "can you tell D.I. Flynn and D.C.S. Gamble what you found, please?"
"I can, Poe," she said.
Leaning into the phone, Bradshaw said,
"D.S. Poe asked me to check all vehicles registered to the Scarfell Veterinary Group."
"What the heck is that?"
Poe noticed Gamble didn't swear at Bradshaw. Drunks in Shap Wells aside, everyone seemed to regulate their language when talking to her.
"They're a veterinary practice, and they used to have a lot of vehicles.
mainly four-wheel drives and Land Rovers. Since the company went dormant, they haven't bought anything.
Tilly, can you get to the... Flynn said.
Showing a resilience she hadn't had a week ago, Bradshaw clipped her boss's sentence.
Until 10 months ago, when two vehicles were bought from a car auction in Derbyshire.
There was silence. Everyone on the call knew that GU Security had their UK headquarters in Derbyshire.
Are you saying what I think you're saying? Flynn asked.
Gamble seemed to have lost his voice.
It was easy enough to check, Poe said. Because of money laundering laws, all car auction companies are registered with HMRC as high-value dealers. That means they can't accept cash transactions over £10,000, so...
So those vans would have had to be paid for via a bank transfer, Gamble cut in. I know how the fucking money laundering law works, Poe. I'm still failing to see how this leads back to one of my finest officers.
Gee, you were very helpful, sir, Poe said, as if Gamble hadn't spoken. Among the vehicles sold to the auction company were 4-cell vans and some of the larger 10-cell trucks. The auction company confirmed that the Scarfell Veterinary Group bought one of each. I've sent you their email.
But,
sir, the Scarfell Veterinary Group is owned by Killian Reed's father.
It took a further 10 minutes for Gamble to get to grips with the fact that one of his detectives might be a serial killer. He clung to the one thing he thought Poe couldn't explain.
It doesn't make sense, Poe. Reed was drugged at the same time as you.
He was, sir, Poe agreed.
Well, then?
What do you know about propofol, sir?
It's an anaesthetic, Gamble replied.
It is, sir. But thanks to Tilly, I know a lot more about it now. It has a multitude of other uses. It's been used as part of the lethal injection cocktails on American death row inmates, and it's used recreationally by some of the more discerning drug users. It's even...
Get to the fucking point, Poe!
Veterinary medicine, sir, Bradshaw blurted out. Vets also use it as an anaesthetic.
Are you saying... The Scarfell Veterinary Group purchased some last year, sir, Poe finished for him. Propofol is heavily regulated, and the drugs company keep an excellent record. I've sent you that email as well. There was a pause.
It still doesn't explain how he managed to drug himself and abduct Hillary Swift at the same time, Poe.
That's because he didn't, sir, Poe said.
I don't understand.
The immolation man isn't one person, sir. It's two, Poe cut in. Reed drugged himself to avoid suspicion. Then his father abducted Hillary Swift and her grandchildren.
Flynn took control.
Okay, Poe. Sir, I think we've heard enough. We need to at least detain D.S. Reed until we've cleared this up, she said.
And can I suggest that someone makes sure Montague Price is where he's supposed to be, Poe said.
That got Gamble's attention. It was one thing not to see the enemy within, another thing entirely for a prisoner in his custody to be abducted.
It's ridiculous, D.I. Flynn,
Gamble said, no doubt thinking ahead. The world was about to crash down on his head.
Steph, Poe said, if DCS Gamble can't, can you? Price is now the only one left from that boat. Killian will want him.
Leave it with me.
10 minutes later, Poe received a text from Flynn.
Reed not at Cumbria headquarters. No one has seen him. Gamble's in meltdown. Any ideas?
Poe sent one back, saying he didn't have any, but he'd get Bradshaw working on it. He doubted Reed would have left a paper trail leading to his location, but he had to do something. After he'd made sure Bradshaw knew what she was searching for, he'd head into Kendall and have a look through Reed's flat before it was declared a crime scene and off-limits. It wouldn't be Reed's containment site, but it might offer something. As soon as he'd sent the text, his phone rang. It was Flynn.
What you got, Steph?
It sounded as if she was running.
Poe, Reed signed Montague Price out of Carlisle Police Station 2 hours ago.
Shit.
Escorted him personally to a...
4-cell GU security prisoner escort van, Poe finished for her.
Exactly. Gamble's staying at HQ to coordinate the search for him, but he's totally lost it now.
I'm coming back down. It seems it's only you and Tilly who have a grip on what's going on.
We'll keep trying to find the address they've been using, then. They won't be at Reed's or his father's. Far too busy. Reed's flat is in the middle of Kendal, and although his father has a small farmhouse, he converted and sold the two barns, so he now has neighbours.
You think the Scarfell group owns a property we don't know about? She asked.
Despite having this discussion over the phone, Poe shook his head.
Tilly's checking, but the company has literally nothing left. George Reed seems to have liquidated his assets. The only things he owns now are the vans.
Best guess?
No idea, Steph, Poe replied. But they've obviously been planning this for years. No way do we find them because of a utility bill.
Nope. I think...
He didn't get to find out what she thought, as at that moment her other phone rang.
Hang on, Poe, she said. My personal mobile's ringing.
Poe could only hear one side of the conversation. It didn't sound good.
Shit, 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 Flynn shouted. Right, I'll tell him to go there now.
Flynn tried to sound calm.
Poe, we need you to go and check something out for us. Apparently, a train passenger has reported seeing someone on fire in a field.
Where? He thought he might know.
A short distance from where you are now. I've sent Tilly the coordinates. Go and check it out, and let's hope it's just kids starting Guy Fawkes early.
He stared at the map Bradshaw had just put on her screen. It was as he feared.
Shit, he said.
What is it, Poe? Flynn asked.
Those coordinates are where the West Coast main line bisects the Kemp House Stone Circle. The train tracks run through the fucking middle of it. If someone did see something burning in the Stone Circle, they wouldn't have been more than 10 yards from it. Hard to mistake a burning body for a wheelie bin at that distance.
Oh, shit,
she whispered. Chapter 54 When he'd been in uniform, Poe was frequently the first officer on scene. Beat cops were usually the first to see unexplained deaths, natural deaths and suicides. When panicked relatives discovered a body, or neighbours smelled something suspicious and organic, their first thoughts were invariably to dial 999. Poe knew how to secure a crime scene. Later in his career, when he'd moved to CID and had been on call, he'd possessed a grab bag, a small rucksack, containing things like crime scene tape, a torch and batteries, a mobile phone charger, forensic suits and warm clothing. His car was always fully fueled, and there'd be pre-packed food in the fridge. This time, the only thing he had was a greenhorn analyst on her first field trip. Bradshaw had refused to stay at the hotel.
I'm coming with you, she said,
and time was too important to spend on an argument he'd surely lose. On the way, he rang Flynn to determine it was the northbound Carlisle train the passenger had been on. Poe grunted in satisfaction. That meant they were on the right side of the railway track, and there was no need for a long detour. 10 minutes later, they were at the side of the narrow field that hosted what remained of the Kemp Howe Stone Circle. Poe stopped the car, but kept it in gear while he searched for signs of Reed or his father. He hadn't expected any. The abduction of Price was a bonus, an unexpected opportunity to get the full list of victims while Gamble's briefing had everyone's eyes elsewhere. Price's murder would have had to be rushed. There wouldn't have been the time for any elaborate staging or ritual. And it didn't matter if Reed were observed or not. Everyone knew who he was now. Price's murder wasn't the endgame, and Reed wouldn't have hung around waiting. Poe checked anyway. There was a part of Reed that Poe hadn't known about, and there was no point taking unnecessary risks. He got out of the car, climbed onto the bonnet, and recce'd the immediate area. It appeared clear. He cast his eyes towards the Kemp Howe Stone Circle. It was perhaps the strangest in Cumbria. Against the backdrop of ancient moorland, it formed part of the Shapstone Row, a collection of rocks that ran for a mile and a half alongside the A6 and the West Coast mainline. It would have been about 25 yards wide if the Victorians hadn't bisected it when the railway was laid. More than half the circle was under the embankment. The remaining 6 pink granite stones were large and visible from both the road and the railway. In among them, something was smouldering. Poe jumped down, got in the car and moved it into the middle of the road to ensure no one could get past. He put on his hazard lights. Turning to Bradshaw, he said,
"Until I tell you otherwise, you're the outer cordon officer. That means no one gets into this field without my permission. Understood?"
She nodded.
"You can rely on me, Poe."
"I know I can, Tilly. There'll be some help here soon. Get the first police vehicle to park 20 yards up that way."
He pointed up the road.
"So we'll block off the road completely. If anyone gives you any shit, shout for me."
Bradshaw stepped away from the car and stood in the open entrance facing out. She looked resolute. Pity the idiot who tried to argue with her. Poe took a moment to make sure he'd done everything he needed to do. Conduct a quick risk assessment. Check. Secure the crime scene. Check. Allocate resources appropriately. Check. Time to go and see if it was a burning sheep. Kids did that sometimes in Cumbria. Or a burning paedophile. If anyone had asked Poe for his preference, he'd have had to flip a coin. For Reed, haste would have become more important than subtlety. Poe suspected that he'd have driven into the field and directly up to the circle. Poe walked along the wall. He had no way of recording the route he'd taken, and this was as good a way as any of ensuring vital evidence wasn't trampled on later. From this point on, everyone approaching the crime scene would use the same route. He was still 50 yards away when the possibility of it being a 6 months too early bonfire night prank disappeared. It was a body. Poe approached it cautiously. It was clear that the victim's injuries were incompatible with life. His charred remains were blackened and smoking. The heat was beginning to crack the skin. Parts of his flesh glowed red. The smell was acrid. Poe bit down on his tongue to stop himself retching. He needed to pull himself together. People were relying on him. The body's arm moved, and for one heart-stopping moment, Poe thought it was still alive. He was about to rush in and start, well, he didn't know what, until he realized that it was the heat causing the muscles to contract. By the time it cooled, the body would be as twisted as a corkscrew. Although he'd have to be formally identified through DNA and dental records, Poe was certain it was Price. He wasn't as badly burnt as the body at Elver Plain, and he could see features he recognized from the video interview. It looked like Reed had been in too much of a hurry to stake him properly. He'd probably only had enough time to cover him with accelerant and set him on fire. As Poe neared the body, he reconsidered. Reed had also made his signature statement. Price's trousers were round his ankles. Reed had castrated him. And judging by the amount of blood on the grass, Price had been alive and unrestrained when his genitals had been removed. Poe scanned the area, but couldn't see the amputated flesh. He suspected it was where everyone else's had been, in his mouth. He looked back towards Bradshaw. He didn't want her seeing this, and was relieved to see she was still facing the road. His phone rang, and he answered it, unable to tear his eyes away from the horror unfolding in front of him.
"Poe," he said. "It's Ian Gamble. Are you there yet?"
"I am, sir."
"And?"
"Bad news, sir. I think it's Montague Price. He's dead, I'm afraid."
"Mother of mercy," Gamble whispered. "What have I done?"
Poe understood. Gamble had Price in custody, and now he was dead, killed by someone under his command. There'd be investigations after this, and Gamble would probably lose his job. He'd certainly never be an SIO again. Poe had a measure of sympathy for the man. No one could have been properly prepared to manage a case like this. A serial killer who was part of the investigating team. Poe had never even heard of anything like that before. Reed knew all the lines of inquiry. He'd helped shape strategy. He'd led on certain things. He knew where Gamble had deployed his mobile AMPR cameras. He knew which circles were being staked out. He knew what the police were doing, and he knew what the NCA were doing. He knew everything. How could that possibly be countered? Yet Gamble had made mistakes. He should have doubled down on Montague Price's security as soon as the immolation man's method of abduction had been identified.
The Prison Officers Association had long ago identified the possibility of ex-prisoner transport vans being used to facilitate escapes. As unlikely as it was, Gamble should have at least considered it. And yes, he should have listened to Poe more often, instead of trying to block him at every turn. Hindsight was a wonderful thing.
"What do you want me to do, sir?" Poe asked. "At the minute, I'm protecting the scene, and Tilly is acting as outer cordon. We could do with some professional support."
"Uniform will be there soon, Poe. Can you make sure they secure the scene? I've also rerouted a DS from the Public Protection Unit. As soon as she gets there, hand the scene over to her. She'll manage it until everyone arrives."
"Will do, sir."
"And, Poe?"
"Sir?"
"I'm sorry."
"About what, sir?"
"About everything."
Poe didn't answer immediately.
"Try not to worry, sir. This is unprecedented. Just remember that. No SIO has ever had to deal with the killer sitting in their own briefing room."
"Thanks, Poe."
The line went dead. He glanced across at Bradshaw. She was waving to get his attention. He could see blue flashing lights. The cavalry had arrived. Chapter 55. Before long, Poe and Bradshaw were superfluous. The well-oiled machine that is a murder investigation had taken over, and they were rightly characterized by the first detective on scene as being unauthorized personnel. People with no need to be on the inside of the cordon. Poe didn't take it personally. If the chief constable had turned up, he'd have been told to get lost as well. More and more police and support staff arrived. They all changed into white forensic suits, and the field looked as though it had a moving mushroom infestation. Poe and Bradshaw offered to help, but in their civilian clothes and with no one to vouch for them, they were told everything was in hand. A gnarly old detective inspector, who Poe had had a fight with over something trivial a few years ago, arrived. He firmly told him he was relieved. They retreated to Poe's car to avoid getting under everyone's feet. Although they would be far more use back at Chapwell's, trying to figure out where Reed was holed up, Poe knew he'd better wait for Flynn. At some point, detectives would need to interview him. With Reed identified as the immolation man, Poe's name being carved into Michael James's chest, and his subsequent connection to the case became clearer. They would want to know everything he knew. He had information that would be needed when the scapegoating began. Someone was going to get the blame for all this. Putting the political ramifications aside, Poe reviewed what had happened. He didn't think Reed would kill Hilary Swift's grandchildren. He was acting psychotically, but up until now it had been cold and calculating. Everything had been done for a reason. Poe believed taking the children was tactical, leverage in case he was located before the job was finished. He also believed that Reed was somewhere near. He'd driven Price from Carlisle Police Station to Shap, ignoring all the circles in between. Poe suspected that Reed had set Montague Price on fire, then driven straight to where he was holed up. It would be close by. Unfortunately, being in the right postcode didn't help much. The Shap Fells were huge and remote. They could be anywhere.
"Poe?"
Bradshaw was staring at him. She was biting her bottom lip, a sign he'd come to recognize that she was worried about something.
"What's up, Tilly?"
"If Reed is Matthew Malone, how are he and George Reed related?"
How indeed? Where did George Reed fit into all this? How did Matthew Malone become Killian Reed? They weren't the only unanswered questions. How had Reed survived Quentin Carmichael and his cronies? When did he and George Reed decide to do something about it? Was it after Reed had joined the police, or was it earlier? Had Reed joined the police so he could do something about it? There was so much missing information. What wasn't missing, though, was the pain Reed must have been feeling for all the years he'd known him. That he'd managed to keep it hidden was almost beyond Poe's comprehension. Would he ever see his friend again? Had he ever really been his friend? Had Poe been part of his grand plan from the beginning? A text alert wrenched him from his deliberations. He looked down at the display, expecting to see Flynn's name. It was an unknown number, different to the one Gamble had used. Poe clicked on the message. His mouth opened in astonishment. "Come alone, and the two children live. Come with Gamble, and they burn. When your sat-nav says you're there, you're not. Keep driving for 0.6 of a mile, then take the next left. After 100 yards, you'll see a sign for Black Hollow Farm. It is literally the end of the road. Park your car and walk towards the house. Killian." It finished with a postcode. Blood began pounding in his temple. This was it. The beginning of the end. Reed had asked for him, and Poe knew he would answer. In his heart, he'd always known he'd end up facing the immolation man alone. He typed a single word reply, "Okay," and pressed send. He put the phone in his pocket and thought about what to do next. He didn't have long. Flynn would arrive soon, and no way would he get to sneak off then. If he was going, then he had to go immediately. Bradshaw was looking at him strangely. She inclined her head in a silent question.
"Just need to run a quick errand, Tilly. You stay here and make sure D.I. Flynn has everything she needs."
"Where are you going, Poe? Who was that text from?"
"Do you trust me, Tilly?"
She stared at him, her myopic eyes burning fiercely under her spectacles. She nodded.
"I do, Poe."
"I have to do something, and I can't tell you what."
"You're my friend. Let me help."
She said it so earnestly he nearly caved.
"Not this time, Tilly. This is something I have to do on my own."
Chapter 56. The address Reed had given him was on the other side of the M6, but the sat-nav directed him to a nearby underpass. Poe wasn't familiar with much of the area after Shap Village. If he needed to go north, he took the M6, not the A6, but he was soon heading up into the fells. Cumbria was one of those counties where you could be on a single-lane track only a few hundred yards from a major motorway, and the road quickly turned rural. Poe doubted he'd see any other vehicles. The people who used this road lived on the fell. It wasn't a route to anywhere, and he suspected it would simply stop at some point. Sheep grazed freely, unencumbered by fences. Poe had driven over 3 cattle grids near the M6, but none recently. Before long, he was high enough up to see the motorway below him. He was on Langdale Fell. The air was beginning to thicken with another ominous fog. It wouldn't be long before visibility was reduced to zero. The sat-nav said he had another 5 miles to go. He crested Langdale and began navigating down a smaller road on the other side of the fell. Even though the sat-nav was working, he stopped to check his AA roadmap. He wanted to get his bearings. He was now on Ravenstonedale Common, the Cumbrian Deliveranceville. He'd never been there before in his life. The road and fog didn't allow a speed much above 30 miles an hour. He followed the sat-nav's instructions, and by the time it told him he was at his destination, he couldn't see a single sign he was on an inhabited planet. He couldn't even see sheep anymore. Poe stopped to check Reed's instructions. In the distance, jagged peaks rose above the fog like headstones. Their definition was fading, though. The fog would reach him soon, and then he would be cut off. Ravenstonedale Common was made up of crags, scree slopes, and unyielding granite outcrops. It explained the lack of sheep. There was nothing for them to eat. The wind whistled down the slope, and Poe could hear water trickling. And nothing else. It was eerie. The moors and fells that usually gave him a clarity of mind impossible in Hampshire now seemed close and oppressive. The fog was low enough for it to have a dreamlike quality. He really was isolated. He put the car into gear and followed Reed's instructions. He took the next left, and after a few hundred yards, he saw the Black Hollow Farm sign, exactly where Reed had promised it would be. Large rocks on the drive and deep ditches either side blocked vehicular access to the farm. The earth was fresh and wet where the rocks had been dragged. The makeshift roadblock had been recently constructed. He wondered why Reed had bothered. It wasn't as if Poe had planned to drive up to the front door. From now on, Mr. Caution was his friend.
Black Hollow Farm was the end of the road. The track stopped where Poe was parked. He turned off the engine and surveyed his surroundings. The farmhouse was bleak and imposing. Poe had thought he lived an isolated existence, but he realized, compared to the men and women who worked these fells, he was almost a city boy. This was extreme farming. Black Hollow Farm was well named. A dark atmosphere hung over it like a veil. Fear, despair, anger. It was in a deep basin. Poe suspected it had once been a quarry, and was cast in perpetual shadow. It was the type of Lake District farmhouse that would never make money from the lucrative bed and breakfast trade. It was a low and stocky building, built to withstand ferocious winters with little regard to aesthetics. It stuck to the ground like a limpet on a rock, and looked to be 200 years old. A sheepfold, a stone pen that afforded sheep shelter in the very worst weather, was attached to the side of the main building. Poe had one on his own land. They were usually circular, or oval, the walls about 3 feet tall, and there was a single narrow entrance. The one at Black Hollow Farm was slightly different. The entrance had been widened, and a huge military camouflage net covered it. Inside was the 10-cell prisoner transport lorry no one had been able to locate. 3 other vehicles were parked by the side of the building. The 4-cell van Poe had spent hours studying, Reed's old Volvo, and a beat-up Mercedes that was presumably George Reed's personal vehicle. Poe took this all in without leaving his car. He removed his phone. Unbelievably, he still had a signal. Now that he'd arrived, the foolhardiness of what he was doing came home to him. No one knew where he was, and even if they did, he was a good 40 minutes from assistance. So why had he come? The smart play would be to call Gamble and leave it to a hostage negotiator or an armed response unit. Anything else was foolhardy. But Reed was his friend. A friend with secrets, but a friend all the same. He didn't know what to do. His text alert went off again. It was the same number as before. It was a 5-word message. "You're in no danger, Poe." Still, he didn't move. Getting out of the car and walking the shale track to the farmhouse was the end of his career. Whatever happened, people would say he should have waited. He thought back to the boy in the photograph, a boy covered in scars, a boy who'd survived against overwhelming odds. His friend. And Reed, despite what he'd become, had been his friend. Nobody could fake a friendship for that long, and Poe owed him the chance to tell his story. Another text. "It's okay, Washington." His jaw hardened. Washington Poe swallowed his rising bile, got out of his car, and walked towards hell. Chapter 57. What was left of the fog-trapped sun was behind the farmhouse. The front was cast in long shadows. It was as silent as the sheet of dead. Although the air was cooling, Poe was sweating. It ran down his spine and pooled in the small of his back. When he was 70 yards away, he stopped. In front of him, and less than 40 yards away, were rectangular shapes. The shadows made it difficult to see what they were. They must have been placed in his path deliberately, like stage props. He approached them. Coffins. 3 of them. Oh, no. Surely not. His forehead knotted with tension. They were laid out on clean blankets. Poe ran his fingers along the warm pine of the first one. The polished brass fittings gleamed. He found his phone's torch function and shone the light on the brass plates. His heart felt as though it would burst. 3 names that would forever remain etched into his soul. Michael Hilton, Andrew Smith, Scott Johnston. The 3 boys were missing no more. Poe snapped some photographs, then looked at the bleak and silent farmhouse, where the 4th boy waited for him. Poe walked towards Black Hollow Farm. The front door was made of oak and was dense and heavy. It was mounted on huge forged hinges, built in an age when things were only made once. The windows were shuttered with the same heavy wood.
The natural courtyard was well-trodden shale. It looked more like a fortified keep than a domestic home. As he got closer, a familiar chemical stench assaulted his nostrils.
Petrol.
Poe's stomach lurched. The back of his throat began burning. Judging by the pervasiveness of the smell, the farmhouse was primed like an incendiary.